We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast for Thursday, January 19th. We are diving into NFL divisional round as the playoffs heat up. Some say this is the best weekend of the NFL season every single year. Let's dive in. Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. I am your host, John McKechnie. Joined as always by Mario Puig. It is NFL divisional weekend. We got four amazing matchups to get us through this weekend. But before we get into that, Mario, what were your big takeaways from last week's action?
Oh, well, I guess, you know, more than a few. I was pretty shocked at the outcome of the Chargers game. Not shocked at the Lombardi firing. Am shocked, however, at Staley not getting fired, and especially the GM not getting fired. That was crazy. Not so many surprises, I guess. I guess that's like all that really, you know, jumped out to me. There wasn't enough shocking things otherwise to really stick in my mind, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the Niners-Seahawks game, good game for the first half, but I wasn't too surprised that the Niners were able to pull away in that one. I actually was a late joiner to the Jaguars-Chargers game. I turned it on, and it was like 17-0, and I was like, oh, well, this isn't looking good for me. I remember I picked the Jaguars to win that one, mostly because I thought that Staley was a bozo, and it helped a little bit that Mike Williams was going to be out, but I didn't expect a 27-point come from behind win, that level of pantsing for the Chargers brass, but there we were.
Yeah, I thought the Chargers would win easily, not as much as it initially looked like they were going to. I thought they were going to win by, like, I don't know, a touchdown, maybe 10 points or something. And so initially, like, I was kind of like, aha, right again. And then when I noticed they're up, like, what was it? They had 17 points or whatever it was, or off of four interceptions, they had like 17 or 21 points. And I remember thinking, like, huh, like 11 minutes left in the second quarter or whatever, and they had all those interceptions, and it's only like 17 points is all they got out of it. That seems like they should have more, like 31. Oh, it'll probably be fine. And then, then it turned out the way it did. So I was happy to be wrong, I guess. I can't believe the way I ended up being wrong, but I did want the Jaguars to win that. So not that I wanted Staley to get, like, I kind of hate some stuff about Staley, but I don't actually want him to get, like, fired or otherwise disgraced, you know? So I was not happy to see that, even though the Jaguars winning was cool, in my opinion.
Yeah. I thought you made some good points last week about Staley, where he can be a little bit too deferential to certain things and not apply his own common sense. If he gets that figured out, I think, you know, the Chargers can be in very good shape. And you know, part of common sense was obviously the firing of Joe Lombardi.
Yeah, but also Telesco, because as much as I hate certain things about Staley and you know, certain things that he's done are just ridiculous, I think, I don't even think this loss was his fault. I think, and also I think they would have lost that game even if Mike Williams was playing. the issue is they can't hold a lead. They can't play real football. You know, they can only play like they can play like arena football or whatever, CFL or whatever that is. But when they get a lead, they can lose it better than anybody, because it's like you can't actually run a full NFL off, like an all situations offense, with basically like draw carry personnel. Like you can't ask Austin Eckler to keep you the lead, even if he gets you the lead in the first place, because he's, you know, he's not built for it. So they can't play between the tackles. They forfeit, you know, like a third of the field every single play. It's like you just can't win over the long run playing that kind of football.
No, and you know, it kind of reminds me of how the Ravens, like they never have any receiver talent, but they've invested in it. I feel like the Chargers, to a lesser extent, they've tried to get running backs, you know, Josh Kelly and Isaiah Spiller. It hasn't worked.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, part of the problem is this indifference to running the football nowadays. This sharp philosophy that you have to not care about running backs at all. That doesn't just cut against it's not that they're just like cutting away at the perceived utility of like really good running backs like Chubb or whoever else. It's that they also say it's like a core, another, you know, byproduct of that is you stop being able to tell bad from good entirely. So you stop being able to make smart, small scale investments too. You get bad at that. Like, let's just say it's sharp to only make small scale investments in running backs. It's still only smart if you make those smart, if you make smart investments on whatever scale that is, and they get these 2 fourth round picks, they turn it into Josh Kelly and Isaiah Spiller instead of, say, like Damian Pierce or, you know, Isaiah Pacheco in this case, this 1 year's case. And it's like you put a player like that in that position, I think you have a different outcome in that game.
No, you absolutely would, because they'd be able to, you know, sustain some drives, run some clock, and, you know, then the meltdown doesn't become an issue. One other, you know, kind of takeaway from the Chargers this season. You know, we brought it up a lot, I felt like, during the off season and, you know, after the draft, and how their receiving core, you know, even if you do have Mike Williams and Keenan Allen healthy, they lack the top end speed. Right.
Yeah.
But you know, so that's a personnel issue, but I also felt like, you know, I looked back at Justin Herbert's numbers for this year, and it's just criminal what they did with Justin Herbert, in the sense that his average depth of throw was 6.5 yards.
Dude, every single snap,
eighth percentile.
Almost every single passing snap for him is almost analogous for a like goal to go situation in any other offense. It's like they have like 8 yards, and then like they might as well have like an out of bounds line 10 yards past that, and that's every single snap. It's like, well, you guys must, anybody who's watched a decent amount of football must remember some plays thinking like in the red zone, like, wow, sure seems like that offense could use a little more room right now. That's how it is every single play for Herbert, and that he does even as well as he has is incredible. If you put almost any other quarterbacks in that scheme, they're just getting all their routes jumped, and it's a mess. And part of the problem too is like not just the slowness at receiver makes it hard to get downfield. Like they literally can't access depths that faster receivers would, and Herbert can't throw as far downfield as he could in other scenarios. It's that, like, when you have that slow kind of downfield personnel, you can still kind of make that work, but you're going to need play action to buy the time for the quarterback, and you're not going to demonstrate credible play action threats with the draw running back personnel. That's where the power element that between the tackles running comes into play again. If they want to have wide receiver personnel this slow for downfield functions, they need to be able to make the defense respond with bigger, slower personnel. And instead, the personnel they put on the field encourages defenses to respond with 5 defensive backs. You know, the people who would be most comfortable running with Mike Williams down the field, and they're not responding to a run threat to make them, you know, approach it differently. So everything they do is literally everything they do is wrong. Everything they do undermines everything else they try to do.
I'm gonna sprinkle in a little wish cast for the draft for them. I would love to see Zay Flowers in a Chargers jersey. I think that would fit very nicely.
Is he a burner? Is he like a downfield guy? I saw that he was good underneath. I didn't know. Is that just because Boston College's quarterbacks can't?
Yeah, Dracovich and Emmett Moorhead.
First round Dracovich, remember that?
Yeah, I sure do. Not a whole lot of noteworthy downfield throwing elements to that offense, but Zay Flowers, like when he started his career, it was like you know, 20 plus yards a catch. And then he started getting, basically 30% of the targets. So it shrunk a little bit, but I wouldn't doubt that he can do anything basically on a field other than be big.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I haven't watched him yet, but yeah, the numbers tend to pass the first inspection. So especially if he tests pretty well, I'll probably like Flowers a good amount.
Yeah, he's a fave of mine. But then looking at Sunday's games, obviously, you know, the Bills 13.5-point favorites had to scrape and claw to get the win over the Dolphins.
That
the
was
Dolphin,
actually a little crazy. Mike McDaniel is pretty impressive.
Yes. I mean, to get that out of Skylar Thompson, like they needed some crazy stuff to happen, of course. But at the same time, you know, like was that more of a case of the Bills looking ahead or do they need to figure something out?
I think the Dolphins just kind of surprised them. You know, it's like McDaniel had them fired up on both sides of the ball and he did what he could with the offense, obviously. So bizarre how it's like everybody who only watched Jalen Waddle in that game, like if that was the first time anybody's seen Jalen Waddle, they're like, oh my God, this guy sucks. And I know that that's like kind of reasonable if that game is the only data point or whatever, but man, he's usually so good and he was so bad in that game. Just bizarre. And I guess he dropped like an early one too, something like that. It was like Thompson actually wasn't so bad initially as I thought he was going to be. And then he was that bad after that. So to keep that game close at all was crazy for McDaniel. And with that said, I would kind of blame the Bills more than I would give like too much, especially for the Miami defense having causing like the turnovers. Like Josh Allen kind of is just prone to turnovers, even though that doesn't really get talked about that much. And that was an example of like what can happen when it goes badly. So you could probably, maybe you can just say for the Bills perspective, like maybe they got it out of the way. Maybe he, you know, got the worst of it done and he can kind of go on a hot streak, or at least they need to hope so.
Right. It's not unheard of for a highly seeded team to kind of struggle in their first game and then, you know, get things going as the playoffs progress.
It's a divisional game, so I don't know.
That's true. And with like recent history, you know, they had just played each other, what, like 3 weeks prior, something like that, 4 weeks prior. So, it was a weird game, but, you know, the Bills are still here. We got, I think, is going to be the game of the weekend. Maybe it ends up being the game of the postseason between them and the Bengals on Sunday. Moving on to the Vikings, Giants. Are the Giants potentially scary there for the Eagles?
Well, the Eagles have to take it seriously, but if they do, I think they're fine. I mean, the Giants, their model is unquestionably dependent on overachieving. And yeah, Dable gets them to do that consistently. It's not like it's not a fluke that they're overachieving. It's like that's just what happens when Dable faces most other coaches. Like if he faces a coach who's as good as game planning as him, maybe they look more like the players that we kind of thought they had all along. But not just that, it's like the way that they've been winning, including, you know, against the Vikings, it's all these things that all these players are producing in ways that they can't count on them to do against the Eagles, and especially all those receivers. Like Isaiah Hodgins has been red hot for a month now. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he can do anything against, Darius Slay, especially James Bradberry. Richie James, been good. He's done a little bit carrying them, especially before last week. Him going against Chauncey Gardner-Johnson seems like a no-go or close to it. Darius Slayton going against presumably Darius Slay and James Bradberry the whole game. He already did that, only had like 42 yards or something on three targets. So Saquon Barkley has to win it for them. And he can, like we can easily enough imagine him going for like 150 on the ground and 50, 60 yards as a receiver. That's not that difficult to imagine, but that's also not the, you know, That's not the typical outcome for Barkley. It's like he has a game like that, you know, every month and a half, 2 months, something like that. So it's just going to be difficult for him to have that specific level of a game against this particular defense, with the defense being able to zero in on him with impunity. Like if the Eagles don't give much safety help to any of those corners, they'll be fine. So if they want to put an extra person, like a robber spy on Barkley specifically, they should be able to do that. And then you're down to just, can Daniel Jones run for like 100 yards? And I doubt it. And people are also losing sight of the people lose like the context of all of Jones's usage. Like, his passing has been very like play action heavy, and they try to limit his exposure. And if they expose him more than they have, they're likely to see those returns decline. And in that same context, this rushing threat is there, this occasional rushing threat. And if you try to make that like a basis of your offense, you're all of a sudden going to have these plays where Daniel Jones is just bootlegging and running just uncovered for like 20 yards. Eventually there will be some guy there to hit him very hard, and then you won't run it again.
Yeah, that's a good point. We'll unpack that game a little bit further. And you know, Jones is running all over the Vikings in the first half, and then the Vikings kind of button that up in the second half. But when it comes to the Vikings, what's the path forward here? You know, Cousins was on a 1-year deal. I imagine that they'd, you know, run it back with him. You still have, you know, an impressive core on offense, of course, but the defense, like we kind of were mentioning all season, was going to be the Achilles heel for them, especially in the secondary. So is this something where if they just make a couple moves in free agency in the secondary and in the draft, that they're able to, you know, kind of get back here and, you know, win as many games next year, but look a little bit more legit doing it? Obviously, they were like basically by points differential, like the worst 12-win team ever.
Yeah, they're like an 8-8 team in the old league. They're in a tough spot, I think, because they have like this burden now of some level of expectation, even though they weren't good. You know, people are having high expectations for them, not on the basis of it's year two, it's time to show something. It's going to come on, go 13-3 again. And that's probably not happening for like 5 years or something like that. So, even if they're a good team in the time in between, but I don't know if that's a given either. It's like Dalvin Cook is probably about toast. Kirk Cousins was a problem this year, and I don't know if it's because of decline in his case or if it's something to do with the system not suiting him as well as the previous ones, but all of his production to the middle of the field this year was just, it's like amazing they could run the offense at all with how bad it was. And the only reason they could run the offense at all was because of Justin Jefferson doing Jerry Rice things at the other one spot in the offense. And aside from him, I should have run the numbers on this. Kirk Cousins' numbers throwing to anyone who isn't Justin Jefferson this year must be something like, it must be like 5.8 yards per attempt or like 6 yards per attempt or something like that. And at like only no more than like 65% completed. So you punt all the time offense. You don't score any points with that offense. And yet that's what they were doing to everyone other than Jefferson, and specifically in the middle of the field. It's like KJ Osborne had okay numbers last year. This year, 6 yards a target. TJ Hockenson was they traded for him, hoping that would fix that issue. They're thinking like, oh, well, Kirk just needs some more yards after the catch in the middle of the field in the slot. And then you look at TJ Hockenson's numbers. It's the same thing. It's almost identical to KJ Osborne's numbers this year. So there was something about this year between either Kirk Cousins or the offensive scheme that made him probably like a bottom five passer in the middle of the field, bottom five passer to anyone other than Justin Jefferson. And that's insane for that to be true. And I feel like it's gone basically unnoticed. So in any case, they have to change the offense or they have to change the quarterback or both. And it might be both. I don't know. If it's just the quarterback, that's no easier of a task. I mean, that like blows up the whole thing potentially.
Right.
So they got to get rid of, I think, I don't know. I guess their draft capital might make it a bad time to try to build around a rookie or whatever. But if they can get a decent rookie, do it. Cousins is toast. This offense might be needing some reevaluation in general as a scheme. Dalvin Cook, they got to move on from probably to shore up some other areas. I will say they probably won't make that many investments in the secondary, or at least fewer than people want to expect. To be fair to them, and Booth and the Missouri one were hurt all year.
Fourth round Missouri. That's a good point.
So if those guys turn out to be as good as they seem to be, and they both, I thought, were good prospects.
Yeah.
They should, you know, be able to do better than whatever Chandon Sullivan next year.
My son Chandon. Let's see. But I guess if, you know, there's some seismic changes, especially at quarterback, Do you feel confident about Justin Jefferson being the fantasy 1-1 next year?
I don't know. I think he'll be fine. Look, to me, it's pretty possible that Kirk Cousins has just been some version of not good, you know, or even maybe less than average. Certainly this year, maybe even longer than that, I don't know. But this year, Cousins just wasn't good. And I think for Jefferson to be able to so Jefferson had such better numbers than the rest of the Vikings targets, right? Like, I don't think that's from the offense selling out the rest of the guys or anything, or I just think he's that much better than everybody. And a quarterback so bad as to make a player like KJ Osborne average 6 yards a target, TJ Hockenson 6 yards a target, is only bad enough to keep Jefferson to the box score that he had this year. So worse than Cousins is possible, definitely, but it's hard. I think it might be surprising how much they could go to a conventionally regarded as bad or inadequate quarterback and see how little changes for it.
And then we'll skip on, or we'll skip the winners of the next two games and kind of quick look forward for the next two losers, the Ravens and the Buccaneers. Looks like both could have different quarterbacks next year. So
yeah, Tampa Bay apparently going to have different everything except the head coach. That's weird.
Yeah, Bowles. I like Todd Bowles.
Yeah, he's out of his element.
Head coach, not there.
It seems like an absolute circus right now. So Tom is definitely gone. I'm like, man, can we get Mike Evans out of there too? Can we get, I don't know. I guess Antoine Winfield's young enough that he can go through a rebuild. But man, get Evans out of there. Put him on a real team because this is about to get ugly.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, the Bucks. It's not going to go well for them. But you know, if you're them, you absolutely take what this Tom Brady era has given you. You went
from, they're I'm not pitying them. Those guys can kick rocks, as the polite people say.
Kick them. And then as far as Baltimore goes, we could spend an entire podcast on this one, but
hate pod, hate-a-thon podcast.
I respect how they played on Sunday night. The visual of Sam Hubbard looking like a Morton Joe on the sideline after running back that touchdown, it's going to stay with me forever, haunt my dreams, my nightmares, everything. But I would have preferred to just have the Ravens get their teeth kicked in than whatever that was on Sunday night.
Yeah, that was just like a long, it's like a 60-minute version of when an older, bigger sibling puts the younger one in a little bit of a arm twist so that they're like, it's not like actively painful necessarily, but they also can't move. And
right. Like, yeah. And you start to move and it's like, ow,
for an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. flicked their ears a couple times when they whined about it.
Oh my God. Yeah. So, but again, we'll get to that when there aren't four postseason games to get to on the slate. So before we do that, we got a message from our friends over at Blue Wire.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic. So now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. In hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
And now, let's kick things off at Arrowhead, Mario, where the Kansas City Chiefs, 8.5-point favorites against the Jacksonville Jaguars, who, again, just had an unbelievable comeback victory at home against the Los Angeles Chargers. So do you think the spread is right? I kind of think that this is where the Jaguars, I don't know, I wouldn't call it luck, but this is the end of the road for them. And I think the Chiefs come out and just kind of really, really take it to them.
I would definitely pick the Chiefs to win, and it could be by, you know, double digits, let alone the 8.5. But I don't know. It's tough for me to think this one through. I feel like there's a lot of volatility. There's a lot of like subtext to read into. Both of these coaching staffs have a ton of playoff the Chiefs coaching staff has a ton of playoff experience. Doug Peterson has a good amount as one part of the Jaguars side, obviously. And Steve Spagnuolo specifically is the one that I wonder about, the defensive coordinator for the Chiefs, because that guy must have like 30 playoff games of experience by now or something. And he's got more than a couple instances of seeming to turn it on more in the playoffs specifically. I guess you'd say, especially when he was the defensive coordinator of the Giants.
Right.
And they beat the 18-0 Patriots. But He's also done it a little bit with the Chiefs, but he also almost kind of, not that he necessarily blew it, I guess the personnel wasn't so great, but like last year against the Bills, like that was no masterclass of a defense, of course. So I don't know. Spagnuolo has had highs and lows, but those also happened. And it's like, if it happens again, that could be a tough one for a player like Lawrence. You know, going on the road is tough enough. Arrowhead is probably, other than maybe Gillette, like the last place anyone wants to go as a visitor, and being in the playoffs, going against Spagnuolo, who probably will call a bunch of things that he didn't show once on tape in the regular season. And we've seen Lawrence make bad initial moves. We've seen him come back from them later, but it would only make sense really if you know, a first time playoff quarterback, a second year player, an underclassman prospect in a second year, moreover, if he kind of failed the test the first time he saw it, that would make a lot of sense. That would be the norm, even for highly successful quarterback prospects. So if Lawrence were anything less than like not good enough to win this, or anything more than not good enough to win, that would be, you know, pretty much a triumph for him. So especially with all of that noted, it feels like the 8.5, at the very least, is not as, you know, risky of an 8.5 as it might normally be. It's not an 8.5 like last week's between, you know, the Ravens and the Bengals. It's like the way it can go wrong for Lawrence is one where the Chiefs score with the turnovers and don't necessarily take much time to do it. So rather than everybody just running out the clock for 45 minutes until someone pulls away at the end, it's like if the Jaguars make mistakes, they can it can look more like the first, you know, 20 minutes of the Chargers game or something. And they probably don't, you know, come back much or at all from it in the case of the Arrowhead scenario. So the other thing that's different from the last time, and we'll talk about this in the cornerback article for this week, which I'm going to make a no paywall just because there's like not as many, you know, games people reading at that point in this point of the year. But Christian Kirk had the big game against the Chiefs the last time, but that was when Lajarius Sneed was still playing the slot most of the time for the Chiefs. And lately it's been more the rookie Trent McDuffie. So that's a little bit of a wild card, but it's not as good of a matchup as it would normally be for Kirk to get against a rookie. McDuffie's just like prototypically built for like slot kind of coverage and maybe even receivers like Kirk specifically. So you'd like it a lot more if it was most other rookie corners, but this actually might be a tougher matchup for Kirk than the first time. And not just that, it frees up Sneed to cover Zay Jones. So if Sneed's on Zay Jones, I'd say Sneed has the upper hand there. Marvin mm-hmm. Jones has everybody has the upper hand against Marvin Jones. If Kirk doesn't go, it's just Engram and Kirk and ETN, and they're dangerous enough. Then the Chiefs definitely have to be careful with those two, but it's not a bad starting point for a defense. If you just know, like, we have to keep like Evan Engram and Travis Etienne under 200 yards and we win.
Right. Yeah. So with this potentially being tough for Kirk and Zay Jones. Yeah. That limits those options for Lawrence. And it was already, like you said, going to be a pretty tough environment to be playing in. I at once think that he like kind of got his playoff jitters out in spectacular fashion in like at one burst, but this still, I think, presents a uniquely tough challenge for him. I expect the Jaguars to maybe struggle to get to much over 20 points in this one.
I could see them getting over 20. I just think the Chiefs will finish with some kind of distance. And so it's like if the Jags get to 28, then the Chiefs probably got to 38 or something like that.
Yep. So I'm on the Chiefs to cover here. As far as the Chiefs offense and how it matches up against this defense, where are the big advantages?
I'm sorry, the Chiefs offense versus the Jags defense?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
So Tyson Campbell, I don't know how good he is. He's some version of good. He could be very good, but even if he's not very good, he's good enough that it encourages you to go to the other parts of the Jaguar secondary just because they are easier in comparison. Like maybe you can beat Campbell if you really need to, but why bother if you can find easier picking somewhere else? And especially the slot, Trey Herndon, and not just him, I guess, but Darius Williams, who's been mostly playing outside after opening the year, mostly in the slot. Valdez Scantling had one of his few good games of the year against the Jaguars, and it's perfectly predictable. It makes perfectly good sense why that would be. It's because of those two corners. Valdez Scantling, he can outrun pretty much anybody in a line. Tyson Campbell, maybe he can beat him deep too, but Campbell can probably match Valdez Scantling deep. However, Darius Williams is like 5'9 and 3/8 tall. Trey Herndon is something like 5'11, 180, and he's not particularly fast. Small corners, skinny corners who are short, just can't really do anything against Valdez Scantling downfield in single coverage. And yet, if, you know, as a defense, you're not going to love the idea of having to put a safety over the top against Valdez Scantling every snap, because you look at the projections, it's like he only gets them like 38 yards a game. Why should we have to double this guy? But you have to do it anyway, or he will just run in a straight line and your corner will be too short to do anything, even if he's right there. So that's something that's always going to be a problem for the Jaguars defense, and I don't know what they can do about it other than leave that safety over the top or just pray that they can keep Valdez Scantling to one of those games where he, you know, doesn't catch any of his five targets. It happens occasionally, but it's still easier said than done. And meanwhile, I feel like the Jaguars run defense will kind of have consistent issues. I feel like they're running like kind of an ambitious defense, and they've gotten a little better with it over the course of the year, but Mahomes' ability to just isolate little parts of the defense and test every single part, whatever part of the defense he wants in a given play from any part of the field, I feel like he'll eventually find some kind of like weak spot, something that the Jaguars just kind of can't really seem to deal with while also dealing with their you know, prerequisite chores of accounting for the big play deep, accounting for, you know, Kelce, whatever amount that they try to. Like, there's, it's always just going to be some part of the, and I guess most of the times this year, it's like Mahomes finds Jerick McKinnon with no one anywhere near him, just like last year when he find Daryl Williams with no one anywhere near him. And we'll see. I've been skeptical that that position, that function, that opportunity is likely to exist in the playoffs. But against the Jaguars, it probably does. So if it's necessary, it'll come down to Jerick McKinnon being uncovered somewhere and Mahomes will find him. And it'll probably be that, or the Jaguars just kind of flail start to finish.
And then, you know, when it comes to Kelce and when it comes to Mahomes is testing every little thing, I do feel like there's a good chance that the Jags just have to deal with a lot of Kelce, at least early in the game, until they can show they can slow him down. How would they go about doing that?
I don't know. I guess the safeties are Andre Sisco and Rayshon Jenkins, and I guess you would figure Jenkins is more the strong safety between the two of them. Maybe Sisco more of the open field coverage kind of guy. I guess that would mean Jenkins would be more likely to be anywhere near Kelce as far as like slot type coverage goes. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't watched closely enough how they use Foyasad Aluikun on like tight ends and stuff. He might be more of like a sits in the middle, sits in some kind of zone coverage drop back kind of linebacker rather than like a one-on-one matchup kind of linebacker. But given how much he's being paid and given that he's built like a safety to start with, I'd kind of hope Aluikun could be part of the answer there, but I don't know. They're I guess more likely just isn't one.
Yeah. I'm thinking huge game from Kelce in this one. And again, I feel like the Chiefs are going to be able to win this one by double digits. But Jags, amazing story this year. Considering where they were 365 days ago, unreal what they're able to do this year.
I will say it's all Doug and Trevor Lawrence pretty much. Trent Baalke is still a complete buffoon, and they should still be better. Man, if they had DJ Chark with this offense with Trevor as playing as he has instead of Marvin Jones, they'd be an actual threat to the Chiefs with that detail alone, in my opinion. But Trent saw differently.
Oh, so we were being sarcastic in our Trent praise earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's get on to the Saturday nighter. We got the Giants going to Philly to face the Eagles, the one seed in the NFC. Eagles 7.5-point favorites. This, of course, the third time that they've met this season. The Eagles drummed them at the Meadowlands, and then I don't know how much you can really take away from the Week 18 game, but, you know, is this the starting point of a serious playoff run from the Eagles, or, you know, is this a team that gets by this week and is, I don't know if exposed is the right word, but maybe aren't quite ready yet to make it all the way to the Super Bowl?
I think they'll be fine in this one. I think the Eagles pretty much roll in this one. Next week would be a different question. I think both Dallas and San Francisco would be pretty concerning matchups for the Eagles. 49ers more so, I guess, probably. But this week, like I was saying a little earlier, the Giants overachieve, you know, almost as a matter of policy, but they still... They're going to be tested on that, you know, not in the same way that the Vikings were tested on maintaining their success, which is to say they needed the statistically impossible to happen. They needed like all these aberrations to just last forever. Like the Giants show up and actually play well enough to kind of do better than their projections would normally merit. But the gap between them and the Eagles is so much that in this particular sort of matchup, I don't know what they can really do. What they need is for Jalen Hurts to have an awful game. And I would prefer that he had gone into this perfectly healthy and didn't have that recent time off. But I just think that the Giants defense is very shorthanded in personnel after the front four. And these receivers against these corners, like, you have to give up so much in the run defense that I don't know what the Giants defense can do other than invite the Eagles to run all over them. And that might be their best option, but I don't know what reason we have to think that the Eagles would fail to respond. Like they can, if that's the adjustment, their counter adjustment is just, all right, Hurts is running it 15 times. Miles Sanders is running it 15 times. And if we only throw it 20 times, then that's all we throw it. And we're kind of content to play that game. So it could just kind of be like the Giants find out, you know, it's like that we keep it closer this way, but we don't actually, you know, close the gap. And basically they need better coverage personnel at corner. They need probably a little better linebacker personnel on defense. Like Martindale has been doing a really good job running that defense all year, and he's going to keep doing that. But that's just all more quickly to the point. They have such little talent in the back seven of that defense. It's crazy that they're ever competitive. And this is the playoffs is where you find the limits of overachievement traditionally.
Yeah, exactly. So that this probably is the end of the road there for the Giants. But when it comes to the spread here, 7.5, do you think the Giants can keep it to that?
That's different, especially if the way that the Eagles need to play, if the Giants sit back out of some sort of, you know, great respect for Brown and Devontae Smith, and then therefore invite the Eagles to run on them, the Eagles could run and run with great success and basically control the entire game and still, especially backdoor cover, give up that kind of thing. Cause if you're, it's like that, the Bengals, you know, Ravens example from last week, if everybody's running, even if it's not actually a competitive game, like the clock can run out so much faster that it's more analogous to playing like a 2.5 quarter game than a 4-quarter one. And it's like, yeah, if it's a blowout, the lead, you know, you need time for that lead to express itself. And sometimes if you're running enough, you just sort of, you know, whereas it feels more maybe like 42-10, maybe it's only 28-10 or something like that. And in this case, maybe it's, you know, they go into the final 3 minutes up 13 points or something. And it hasn't been close all game. And the Giants still kind of just pad a touchdown at the end quick.
Yeah. Interestingly, the Giants are getting 65% of the betting money on the spread.
I will say, I do think some of it is a feature, you know, a predictable, repeatable sort of detail of the Brian Daboll effect on the offense, but Daniel Jones has not turned the ball over much at all this year, and he hasn't faced extended exposure all year. Like so much of the Daniel Jones, you know, hype that's coming out now, it's failing to note how much the offense that he's having this career year, yes, but note how much the offense still tries to hide him and wonder why that might be, and expect to find out why in a game like this.
Yeah, and you know, like the rushing ability from him, you know, the Eagles are well aware of it, and they also face a better running quarterback in practice every day. So I feel like
those corners don't need much help. They really don't. I mean, Bradbury and Slay shut down Slayton. Hodgins, even when he's on, he's not threatening you 12 yards downfield, you know? And so I don't know, deep pass rush. Did you notice Hassan Reddick has like 17 sacks this year? There's a lot on that defense.
Yeah, they get after it. It's pretty scary. So I think my lean is to go with the Eagles to cover this one. And
the Eagles, yeah. It's got to be a bad game from Hurts, and maybe that shoulder thing is a cause for concern. But
sure,
I have to act like it isn't, and you know, just kind of try to guess what these teams are at their, you know, base evaluation.
Yeah, I think that he has been off the injury report all week.
He should be fine. I mean, they gave him those 2 weeks for a reason, and it should have been enough right there, hopefully.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking as well. Let's get on over to Sunday. Let's get on to Bills-Bengals. Bills 5-point or 5.5-point, depending on where you're looking. Point favorites, the over-under in this one, 48.5. Depending on which book you're looking at. Again, both of these teams played B-minus games last week. I'd say it's a fair grade for each of them. The Bengals, obviously, I think that, you know, we're running into a time is a flat circle thing where the offensive line could be an issue again, just as it was in the postseason last year. But they still were able to overcome that and make it to the Super Bowl, obviously. But, you know, you lose Kappa. Jonah Williams dislocates his kneecap last week, and, you know, he's considered week to week, and it's not like he's amazing by any means either. So you got like Jackson Carmen playing meaningful snaps.
I was going to ask who the left tackle is now, because I was like hoping it was Adeniji or whatever, but it's, of course it's Jackson Cartman.
So that's that could be an absolute issue. You know, that could be the thing that sinks them.
Like Cartman wasn't even doing anything at guard where they were hoping he could not. Like they basically know he's not a tackle. So yeah, that's the problem for the Bengals right there. And I don't know what they can really do, but I guess they could sort of play a run heavy game. The Bills, I think, can be tested in the run defense. Unusual crank opinions is that I'm convinced Tremaine Edmonds is just awful, and I think everybody just thinks he's like pretty good or very good, and I'm over here just muttering to myself about he's no good, Milano's better or whatever. But
Milano's sick.
Yeah, Milano's really good. He's their only good linebacker though, in my opinion, and I don't know. Edmonds is kind of just a guy. I don't mean to make it sound like he's some sort of huge liability. He's fine. He just kind of like rides the wave of the defense. But the run defense, I still think, can be tested. And I think part of the way that the Bills get such consistent overachievement in their secondary, and you look at them play and you're like, why are Jordan Poyer and like Micah Hyde looking like dual Ronnie Lott's back here? Like, what the hell is going on? And I think some of that is like some of their philosophy, especially of like how they utilize the safeties, sort of leaves a bit of a vulnerability between the tackles and you know, dive plays, things like that. But they're trying to, certainly with the Josh Allen offense, they're hoping to pressure you into just throwing the ball anyway to, you know, catch up to them. And they're hoping that they can, you know, just win with their chances in the run game. Like if you're going to test them on it, they hope that they can kind of just like call the bluff a couple times and not have to get tested again and again over the course of the game, because I think over the course of the game there's only so much they can do to hide that limitation. And with Mixon and P. Ryan, the Bengals can credibly push for 40 carries from the running back position and get pretty decent production out of it. But if they have to do like deep drop backs and, you know, trying to get the big play, basically, I don't know how they're going to get the big play with offensive tackles like these, because I don't know how you're going to run a five-step drop. It's like Burrow's got to get rid of the ball quick. Well, these corners do a lot of, they get in your face and stuff, but they also they set up a lot of like kind of pouncing sort of looks to jump routes. And they bank on that. They figure out, you know, by this second count, the ball pretty much has to come out. So if it's that late in the play, just start looking for the ball, you know, just start looking for the quarterback. See, like the ball is probably coming out any second. So, you know, take your chance and it'll usually work out. So if Burrow can't make them guess wrong for that, if he can escape a little, I guess is how he'd have to do it. But even with Von Miller out, like Rousseau is tough to get away from. And who's that? They had another one who was doing pretty good.
AJ Epenesa?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Not him.
I don't think so.
I don't think he's a real player, really.
Luca Garza of Iowa football.
Yeah, I mean, it was – he's great at the non-NFL game. You got to go in that. But I think, I don't know, Kair Elam maybe gets a little more work after playing well last week. They actually had him rotating with Dane Jackson, who I guess he works well in their scheme. He's got to be better than like Levi Wallace was or whatever. But Chase obviously will make you run at some point. If Burrow gets to 4 seconds, it's like you need someone who can actually – someone's going to need to run and chase, pursue Chase. That might be easier said than done for the Bengals to arrange, but if they do, that the Bills are the ones who are kind of on the run in that point. So there's some things that the Bengals can do on offense, but I don't know. I'm worried because I definitely think Sean McDermott's the best defensive backs coach in the league, and he learned for many years under Jim Johnson in Philadelphia. He's playoff tested himself at this point. So I don't know. I could imagine this game being lower scoring than anyone like to see. By the way, it's not just the Bengals offense that I have concern for.
So I guess one, you know, thought that's bouncing around in my head as it pertains to the Bengals and the skepticism you can approach them with, given the offensive line problems. But is there a quarterback who's kind of better suited to like kind of know what to do in those situations than Burrow? I mean, he hasn't had a good offensive line since he's gotten to the league, and he dragged that offensive line to the Super Bowl last year. So, I mean, it's not like that this is like Tom Brady where, you know, all of a sudden, you know, a couple of all pro or Pro Bowl level guys are removed from the equation and the performance isn't as good. And he has to get rid of the ball extremely quickly. Like Burrow, he's still athletic, obviously only in his third year. Like he can move around. I think he doesn't get quite as much credit as he deserves for his athleticism. I feel like maybe this is kind of where I've come around to it. Maybe the offensive line issues could be overblown, but maybe if Von Miller was out there, then I would feel differently about it. But as it stands, maybe I'm not as petrified about Burrow just getting folded up as I would be.
Yeah, fair enough. I that's a tough one for me to sift through just because last year, yeah, Burrow weathered that storm, but they still should have lost against the Titans. It's like if you get sacked, what, 9 times?
Yeah, that was
that's an auto loss against like 99 times out of 100. And the struggles were real too. You know, it's like it'd be one thing if every game for him were this thing where, yeah, he got hit 15 times, but you know he turned it over twice, but we'll take that 340 and 4 touchdowns every time. It's like he's got legitimately bad games sprinkled in there, especially early this year. Like, that Pittsburgh game week one was just brutal. It shouldn't have been that hard, and yet it was. What's changed is Zach Taylor has generally done a better job game planning and managing play calling in games since then. So hopefully that's another thing that's in Burrow's favor that was not last year. But it's just risky, and it's like Burrow's played in every type of situation. It's like at LSU, he had absolutely everything. You know, he had the Monstars for his team. Mm-hmm. And he put up the big numbers. Like you said, he's had the opposite of that at times with dealing with this pass blocking. That's could hardly be more difficult, especially in comparison to the LSU situation. So he's tested more than like his NFL playoff. Like he's got as much like veteran Wiles factor is someone who's played like twice as many playoff games as he has. It's just all these things also apply to the Bills. It's just there's a lot of there's often in football, you know, it's a classic scenario in football history of like having great players kind of just clash and one has to lose every time. But a lot of the times, too, when you look at these players' careers at the end, it's like, yeah, those are the years that this guy and his team, they won those years, but then we won these years. And it was, you know, it turns out to be a back and forth over, you know, a certain amount of time. That's probably what this game is. It's like somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose, but it's probably not going to be because either team is clearly better than the other. And they're going to kind of just do this give and take for years where, you know, they're going to lose some, win some. And, to me, anyway, it's like kind of anyone's guess who gets the first loss in that, you know, that those series of games against each other.
Yeah, sign me up for a lot of Burrow versus Allen. I can totally get behind that. On the Bills side of things, obviously their run game continues to be an issue. So I mean, I'm not drawing the direct comparison to what we were talking about earlier with the Chargers. And I don't expect the Bills to get the kind of lead where they like need to choke it out for an extended period of time. But, that is something that could potentially keep the Bengals in this one. But, you know, as it comes to Allen, how does this matchup look for him? And, you know, where are the weak spots in this Bengals defense? Who on the Bills offense could really kind of show out?
So, like I said, I was saying I had those various concerns for the Cincinnati offense, but I'm concerned for the Bills offense, too. And you're right, to draw that kind of parallel almost of the Chargers. The one difference and the reason that the Bills don't get, you know, pinched for it quite as much as the Chargers do is whereas the Chargers just go, all right, right, let's give five carries to whoever. Sony Michel, Josh Kelly, who cares? Maybe that'll work. And it doesn't. The Bills, they say, all right, should we give the ball to what's his name? Or just make Allen run it. And
yeah,
Allen runs it, and it works out better than when Sony Michel or whoever run it in the Chargers case. So the Chargers don't put Herbert's body on the line over and over and over and over in just every conceivable situation the way the Bills do.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to be morbid or whatever, but that I think we've already seen it have a little bit of a cost on Allen. It's like he takes a lot of hits, and yeah, he doesn't take the worst of almost any of them, but there's a reason you don't see quarterbacks running, you know, 20 plus miles per hour into the teeth of the defense over and over and over in the NFL. It's even Lamar Jackson, you know, it's like he is more of like, I'll try not to get hit kind of runner. Whereas Allen just goes straight, just kamikaze every time at the middle of the defense. So that's their method. It's gotten better results. Of course, I question, you know, what kind of wick you're working with that kind of approach, but for one game, any given play, of course, it's like, well, yeah, Allen's the problem here. It's the defense that has to worry. So that's how they bail themselves out. You know, when maybe it would have been conventionally good to have a running back who could kind of get you 15 yards on four carries here, you're just going to have to hope Josh Allen does instead, because it's better than banking on Singletary or Cook. Neither of them is reliable. Cook's had explosiveness, you know, he's been extremely explosive, but he runs these such delicate play structures that they just can't scale up. If they try to make the James Cook plays like a staple run play of their offense, they're going to do it one time and Allen's not even going to get the handoff completed. It's good, like someone's going to come knifing through the line, blowing up the handoff, and they can't look to that for scale. If they go to Singletary for scale, you give up explosiveness, you take on fumbling liability. So it has to be Allen, and we'll see how that goes for them. But I think they could lose this game, not so much for that reason. It's just kind of like the Bengals defense is just good. It's like there's a lot of team. Like we've seen the Bengals defense give trouble to the Chiefs specifically. So if we think the Chiefs are basically the most feared offense in the league, and I consider Mahomes and himself the most fearsome offense in the league, so I consider myself in that group. The Bengals have to be a concern for anybody, including the Bills. And if the Bills have these sort of concerns, then it's a bad time to have your concerns. It's a bad time to have questions to answer when you have to go against the Bengals defense. So specifically, if Lou Anarumo finds a way to limit Stephon Diggs right there, the whole game comes down to Josh Allen scrambling, I think, and running. All the slack will fall to that, because I just can't see – I can't see a base rushing attack doing a whole lot for the Bills. I mean, Singletary and especially Cook can crack, you know, a nice run here or there. The more like a draw, the better for them, which is to say the more serious in between the tackles, the worse for them. So I think it's kind of like a flimsy rushing attack that they can only go to for little bits of time, both because that's an inherent limitation of limited running back personnel like Singletary and Cook, and also because the Bengals will eventually stuff you. Like if you get a couple big runs on them, you should probably look at it as like, all right, we got what we can there, we need to find something else, or else we're just pushing our luck at that point. And like DJ Reader especially, when he's on the field, they're tough to run on. Like Logan Wilson might be a bit underrated as a linebacker. The safeties play really well, almost as well as those Bills ones. So if Diggs is contained from a Lou Anarumo just kind of whatever custom game plan for dealing with Diggs, that reduces the offense to just Gabe Davis running too far downfield. So they use Davis too far downfield. Like some of those intermediate underneath targets they basically give to Beasley and McKenzie, if they found a way to make targets, viable routes and targets for Davis on some of those reps, they would get better results out of Davis and their broader offense. But particularly when they do this thing where Davis has to run 15 yards downfield for his targets, like, okay, you better have time to throw then. That's a far depth downfield, and Davis is not a speed guy. Can you block that long? I mean, it's not the most feared pass rush in the league, but the Bengals give you plenty to worry about in the pass rush. I'd say they're three strong at defensive end now, which is different from last year. Like, Osai is going to kind of just sneak up on everybody. but he's going to get going in the next year or so. So I don't know if the Bills can bank on Davis getting far downfield. And even if he does, like, Cam Taylor-Britt and Eli Apple are both big and fast corners. Like, they might not be great or whatever, but Davis, in my opinion, is operating in a role that doesn't perfectly suit him. So I think the Bills got to worry with just as little as the fact that Taylor-Britt and Apple totally match Davis's athletic traits. They neutralize the build advantage that he often has. He doesn't have gear. He's not going to be open. He doesn't have that much time to get open. If Diggs doesn't step up, it's just on Allen.
Right. And you know, you mentioned the safety personnel for the Bengals. Would that neutralize, you know, that kind of other option when it comes to Dawson Knox?
Right. The Bills have been going to Knox a little bit lately, and
right.
He's good for his role, but I think if they become dependent on him for more than his customary role, that's when you got to start worrying about stuff just going wrong. I think in ways that it could be, you know, it could be a mundane version of going wrong. Like you throw it to him and he doesn't catch it this time. Last week he caught it. Maybe that's the only difference. But Lou Anarumo is going to have, I think, you know, not necessarily the guy's always going to have a great game plan. Even the best coaches get, you know, beat from time to time. Sometimes they have bad ideas, even if they almost always only have great ideas. So Anarumo is not infallible, but in general, if the Bills start showing a tendency, they need to worry about him picking up on it and instructing the Bengals defense accordingly. And so far, it's not often that you see the Bengals defense get blindsided. It's usually like they surprise the other team with how well they're playing, and maybe they kind of lose a little bit of it. Maybe they're not truly dominant as a defense, but they kind of have a way of just being more of a nuisance than you expect.
So with all of that being said, I'm going to say the Bengals do it. I'm going to say they go into Orchard Park and come out with the win.
This is one of those games, like, I just cannot pick. Like, I really can't.
I hope more than anything that it just delivers. Like, I hope that this game is as good as it should be.
I think it's going to be lower scoring than people traditionally want. You're going to see complaining about it. But I think people who value more, like, pre-2010 NFL football will say it was a really good game, because I could imagine this being more about running than people would like, which, by the way, the more that's the case, the more it helps the Bengals.
Yes.
Or at least, like, for 10 plays, you know, it's like you take Josh Allen over the cumulative Bengals rushing attack. But like I said, you can't really get to 20 carries with Allen. You certainly can't get to 30. The Bengals can get to 30 with those two running backs. And I think they're better suited to run defend than the Bills defense even. Okay, so I guess if I have to pick, I'll say the Bengals, but I really don't want to pick. And it's like if some side wins by a lot, I don't know. Maybe either side can win by a lot or lose by a little. I don't really know. But the less the Bengals can utilize that run game, the worse for them, I think. And I think it would almost necessarily attest to either the Bengals being unable to run, which would just kind of be bad enough on its own. And also it could indicate the Bills scoring enough to take away the run option as a base function. So if by indirect or direct means, if the Bills can stop the Cincinnati run game, I like their chances more. It's just, I am concerned about that specific thing.
Right. Yeah, the people always say, like, the Bills defense is meant to stop Patrick Mahomes in the Chiefs offense. Bengals is a little different.
I think they meant for – I think they also think, too, that Tremaine Edmonds is good enough to put some muscle in the run defense there. But, yeah, I think if the Bengals stick with the run, Mixon and Perine are big backs. It's not going to be like a big explosion in the run game. But if they keep the game close for like a quarter and a half and they stick with the run game, I think they're going to eventually see – linebackers just taking false steps, being a step slower than they were the first time, etc. Whereas the Bills can't really do that. Like, if it's like they just like wear out their little running backs faster than they wear out the defense when they run.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Cincy does it. They got something to them. Let's round it out here. We got Cowboys Niners. Speaking of pre-2010 football, you know, that is a classic NFC matchup. But obviously very different now. You know, the Cowboys, interesting, win on Monday night. You know, that I thought Dak Prescott played the best game of his postseason career to this point. You know, pretty much everything was working for them on offense. Special teams, obviously, not quite as much. Do you think that is like a factor going into this game? Like how rattled Brett Maher is?
And it could be. The yips are real. Like especially for the first two missed extra points, I was saying like, guys, we can't cut Maher. He's automatic from long range. And for me, that's like all I really actually want out of a kicker is like, if I have to just do a 2-point conversion offense or something, I guess I'll just do that. As long as the kicker makes 60 yarders whenever I want. Are you kidding me? Like Maher has the NFL record. He has 4 made 60 plus yard field goals. That's crazy. He has more than Justin Tucker, everybody, more than Morton Anderson. He of all kickers has the most from beyond 60 yards. And he's like, especially after that game, I'm pretty sure he's more reliable from 50 plus yards the past 2 years than he is on extra points. So maybe all Dallas really needs to do is just either let the clock run out 3 times or go to the ref and say, like, we would like to kick this from our 35, not our 15 or whatever it starts out at. And just let him kick 50 yard extra points. I mean, problem solved.
Problem solved. As far as I'm concerned. Dang.
But yeah, it's like, I don't know. I'd have a lot of trouble cutting a kicker who can make like 90% of his kicks from beyond 50. That's crazy. So it's a very Dallas Cowboys kind of problem to have. Like they kind of have a way of inventing new kinds of drama that you just sort of, you felt safe crossing it off as a possibility before. It's like, let's see, how are the Cowboys going to blow it this year? Like, ooh, what if they have a kicker who is just godlike from beyond 50 yards, but the catch is that he misses 4 extra points at a time in a row, and maybe they lose in the playoffs because they it comes down to an extra point rather than a, you know, the more classic story of the field goal, the last second field goal. It's like, he'll win you the last second field goal, but if it's an any point in the game extra point, he misses it and blows up the whole thing. Year over, got to rebuild now. That would be a very Dallas Cowboys way to end the season. But and also Dallas's recent history. Oh, it looks like John's got the internet monster again. Dallas's somewhat recent history anyway. They had Mike Vanderjagt with the most legendary case of the yips of all time. Like he was like the top kicker in the league with the Colts. Then he got the yips after he missed something in the playoffs, got into a big public feud with Peyton Manning. John's back, it looks like. But yeah, after the missed kick and then the Peyton Manning going posting on him at the Pro Bowl, he just got the yips and he never came back. And Vanderjagt was always this guy who talked a lot of crap and stuff and was very I'm the coolest kicker ever was kind of his thing. And he got the yips so bad, he just kind of had to walk away with his tail between his legs. He really went from never missing anything to missing absolutely everything. The difference is Brett Maher doesn't have like Peyton Manning making voodoo dolls of him or whatever. So hopefully,
yeah.
Hopefully Maher can be okay and doesn't get like a truly permanent case of the yips. Because it'd be a shame. He doesn't seem as dislikable as Vanderjagt. So it's like, why should he have to go to the same hell as Vanderjagt? What did he even do that was so bad anyway? I don't know.
Canadian kicker, all liquored up or something. Is that what Peyton Manning said?
Peyton Manning's like, what you have here is you have an idiot kicker who got liquored up, ran his mouth off. I don't remember exactly what he said, but I remember I was actually watching that live, and I was much, you know, younger. And I was like, well, what the hell is going on there? Why are these guys fighting, and why are they doing this at the Pro Bowl or whatever?
Yeah, that was because I guess at that point Manning hadn't won a Super Bowl, so he had started to kind of get the choker narrative. And he's like, nah.
Yeah, he had that very much. And he actually had some pretty bad games initially. So it's like one of those things that both were true. But yeah, it's funny because if you listen to people talk about Peyton Manning now, you'd think like he only did great and that they always supported him every step of the way and never had any criticism. And I was like, oh yeah, I knew in those first 6 playoff losses that he'd eventually be the best ever. It's like, no, there's. there was a time when it wasn't so clear.
Yeah, I mean, like it. Yeah, some of those games against the Patriots were
right, especially
horrible.
Brady was ahead of them, and I guess kind of is. But back at the time, Brady was the reason there was any. Like you'd have people who believe that both Manning was not the best, you know, competitor or whatever, and also not the best technically adept quarterback. Whereas now it's like everyone, even like Manning's critics say, like, yeah, he was the best, like he was the most technically adept quarterback ever, even if he had even if he choked a little.
Yeah, because yeah, and I tend to agree with that sentiment. That guy.
And it's important that you know all of this to understand the present day compelling drama that is Brett Maher. And but yeah, if it does come down to him, I guess Dallas, you know, could be in a lot of trouble. 4 missed extra points is pretty insane. I don't understand how he did it. It's the kind of thing that's going to stick in his head forever. Every time he goes up for an extra point now, he's going to be like, remember when you missed 4 of these in one game?
In the
anyway,
playoffs?
Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe it's the kind of thing, like, because Dallas got him through it, now he's, like, invincible or something. Like maybe.
Yeah, the slate's wiped clean. Maybe, you know, they just sent him out for an ayahuasca retreat to cleanse the mind earlier this week, and he's back. And
for kickers, you know, it's good. Yeah, and he's ready to go. Still, the 49ers, sorry, not to skip the Buccaneers too much, I guess, but they're toast. Who cares?
Yes.
Dak was good though all along, so it's not, especially with the San Francisco defense showing some cracks lately, it's still dangerous for Dak and the Cowboys offense, but it's not I'm not quite as worried for them as I would have been like 6 weeks ago. And again, that's more from the kind of proactive perspective of the 49ers defense. I never really bought the idea that like Dak just, you know, sucked or whatever. It's not like this last game convinced me that he's actually good. I thought he was always actually good, but the 49ers defense was so good earlier in the year. I thought this is a total buzzsaw. Like anybody other than Mahomes and like maybe somebody else is in trouble against this defense. Whereas lately they've been giving up big plays, and I guess it's something that I should have seen coming because their cornerback personnel is still bad. It's like they got Tre'Davious Ward, who got smoked himself against the Seahawks. And it's like, God, if Tre'Davious Ward's getting smoked, what can we even do about this? Like, what we got nothing. He'll probably bounce back just because he's not a bad player. Although he did look almost kind of like hurt on that one deep pass to DK Metcalf. So hopefully he's not dealing with a tweak or whatever. But he'll play better. It's the other corners that are the problem. Not even Jimmy Ward. Like Jimmy Ward in the slot has been good. Diamador Lenoir has been a target the last couple years. And if you get like a dime formation, whoever that fourth corner is, like I guess that Toledo rookie or somebody, like Lenoir and that Toledo rookie or whoever they're, Janoris Jenkins, whoever they're putting at that fourth corner spot, like they could be a problem for the 49ers. The question is whether, I guess, the 49ers pass rush intervenes before those corners lose their assignments and coverage. And particularly with Dallas's offensive line struggling, shuffling, I believe the Jason Peters at left tackle, Tyler Smith at left guard, Tyron Smith at right tackle last week was the first time they've trotted out that combination. Continuity is really important on the offensive line. That was kind of concerning to me when they made that switch. Like, just leave Tyler Smith at left tackle, have Connor McGovern be the left guard, put Jason Peters on the bench. He's 42. This is ridiculous. Just this is all you got. Just stick with it. Like, hope they get better, because you're not going to get better by benching McGovern, moving Tyler Smith to a different position, and then putting Jason Peters on the field.
I will say, I have a direct historical comparison to that. The Ravens 2012 Super Bowl run. They had benched Bryant McKinney, then they put him at left tackle for the start of the postseason and put Osemele at left guard or something, and it worked. But
that's
some esoteric that's, knowledge right there.
Like, yeah, even I forgot that one. But yeah, I think there's no Bryant McKinney. It's the old man Jason Peters, and
yeah.
Also he's hurt, so.
Right.
I guess they're going to have to go back to the Tyler Smith at left tackle and McGovern at left guard kind of thing. But in any case, this is really not the defensive line that you want to run into while you're pondering your best offensive line format and making switch at left tackle, whichever way you do it. So, yeah, it's bad. The 49ers defense, I was just talking about how they've been getting worse lately.
Right.
It's possible that tide turns a little bit the other way up, especially in the defensive line, because I guess it's been about 6 weeks they've had Armstead, but they're just now getting Kinlaw back to his customary workload. So Armstead, Kinlaw, Bosa, that's a lot. And Ebukam or whoever else, that, like, everybody that they're putting in to rush the passer is causing problems, and they might look even better as the playoffs go along here, and that would necessarily be at Dallas's expense. So, and if Dak's getting just clobbered all the time, like, yeah, then he's probably going to turn the ball over eventually.
And then, you know, I thought one of the bigger details of Monday night's game was Dalton Schultz and his performance. You know, how does he match up against the safety personnel?
Yeah, that was definitely the best game of his career. I just wonder. I mean, I actually don't wonder. I think if they need to go back to him for more of that, they just lose. Because it's so easy to imagine even that last game going a little differently. Not for Dallas, but for Schultz. Like, that big catch that he had, it's like the left sideline maybe. He had to bobble it, kind of. And it's like, most of the time, he's probably not catching that pass. And sometimes these red zone targets that he gets from Dak are kind of just, like, improvised. He doesn't really beat anybody. He just sort of goes where he's supposed to, when he's supposed to, and sometimes there's an opening that flows to where his route was going to be anyway, and plays hard and stuff. He plays smart, but I don't think he can dictate anything. The most he could dictate this game is if he is deemed worth the attention of Fred Warner. And if you're Dallas, if you take a zero for Schultz in exchange for keeping Warner away from CeeDee Lamb, you do it. Mm-hmm. And by away from CeeDee Lamb, what I mean is, you would really in this matchup, as Dallas, like to be able to set up a matchup where you get CeeDee Lamb going across the field, and especially if he's being followed by Charvarius Ward, you as Dallas want to take Ward laterally as much as possible, as far across the field as possible, because Ward's at his best just going vertical on the sideline. He's tall and he's fast and he can jump high. But going laterally is not what he does best. What he's best at is going in a straight line and jumping and knocking the ball down if you try to complete a pass down the sideline. So if he has to track CeeDee Lamb across the field, and he might not, I mean, they might do some kind of zone thing to in anticipation of this. But if Lamb goes across the field and Fred Warner's there, that's just as bad as any other scenario, pretty much. It's like you got to get him running across the field and hope Fred Warner's worrying about something else. Because if Fred Warner on any given play is thinking, I just got to shut down Lamb, I got to watch Lamb on the crosser, like, that's, you know, you're back to needing Schultz to make a big play for you. And maybe he can make some play, but against a defense like this, I think the catch is more likely, you know, 6 yards on third and eight, something mm-hmm. like that.
So, all right. So that I'm definitely gonna be keeping an eye on what or how exactly Warner is
maybe,
deployed.
T.Y. Hilton and Gallup need to step up against Lenoir on the other corner.
I mean, Hilton
looks
fine
to me. I don't know why. I mean, there's got to be some kind of catch. Like, maybe he just has fresh legs, and being 33, 34 or whatever, maybe he's going to get to snap 100 and all of a sudden run a 4.6.
Yeah.
I don't know. But he looks pretty fast right now. And yeah, if they get a one-on-one with Lenoir on T.Y. Hilton and Dak gets 3 seconds, that's something Dallas needs to go deep on, because, you know, you're not going to get many shots like that. And when there's so many other ways you could imagine production being stalled by the 49ers defense, like, you need to keep your eyes open for that, you know, big shot. You know, it's like, you got to be patient for it maybe, but when it's there, you need to take it, because you're not going to, like, grind your way to first downs otherwise. Like, you need the big play to shovel them and get you, like, a quick burst of points that you don't normally get in the baseline projection, and then you need to lock in your anomalous game that way.
And then on the other side of things, you know, the Niners offense looked great last week. Do you think
it
continues?
Man, that was one of the most uncompetitive defensive. It's still not being properly contextualized. You know, the Brock Purdy numbers, of course, were really good, but more than anything interesting to say about Purdy, I think there are things to say about just how badly the Seahawks defense was beaten in that game. I mean, like, those throws that Purdy was getting set up were plays that you only see when a defense has been completely conquered. Like, they were just they were annihilated. That was ugly how badly they were getting beaten. And yet, you see a lot of the talk now. It's just like, well, man, Purdy really lit them up. Like, in the same way that almost literally any quarterback who has been on an NFL roster going back 40 years would have. Like, I actually can't think of any quarterback bad enough to blow those throws that Purdy was getting set up. And, like, it's good for Purdy that he's, you know, poised and he doesn't look a gift horse in the mouth. And then, you know, I guess to keep the metaphor going, throw it, at the horse's face really hard at point blank. But, like, that's the kind of, like, it's a bumper bowling. It's whatever you'd like to call it. But, like, the throw to Debo was basically like a warm up. That's like playing catch with your dad football right there. And, your dad runs 70 yards after the catch against the NFL defense. Everyone cheers for you. Must be nice. But if those yards after the catch aren't there, if there's a defense getting in the way of the initial throw, which he could have done, he could have granny style passed like a lot of these throws that he made, and it would have been the same exact result. So if you believe the game will continue to be that easy for Purdy, then yeah, he can keep making those plays, and he can probably make some plays that he wasn't tested on either. I mean, it was so easy. Like, I would concede that Purdy didn't get tested himself either. Like, it's not as if he had to strain to make any of these plays, so he could do more. We could see what he looks like when he has to actually, like, you know, grind a bit and dictate a little bit, but he hasn't done it yet. The one times that he's gone over 30 pass attempts in the game was against the Raiders, who are awful, and there was that other really bad defense. I can't remember who. Anyway, the Raiders game, even that one, you started to see it fall apart when Purdy got over like 30 pass attempts. The big plays started being more infrequent, more incomplete passes. He turns it over, which he normally doesn't do. So the Dallas defense can bring about some of that, those kinds of risks. I just think the 49ers should be fine because I don't think Dallas can stop the ground game with the 49ers. And especially with, I wrote about this a little bit in the cornerback article for this week. I think you're going to see Shanahan, not just to maybe a little bit to send a message kind of, but also, as a matter of practicality, he's going to try to get Debo Samuel lined up one-on-one against Trevon Diggs in the ground game. He's going to try to make Diggs tackle Debo Samuel. And I don't know if you saw it. I don't know if this is always a problem. To be fair to Diggs, I don't usually notice him as much as I did last week. But he looked like the trope about the caricature of Deion Sanders being like unable to tackle.
Yeah,
that was Diggs last week, man. It was crazy. I mean, I guess he was trying, but if he hadn't been trying, he would have done about as well. So I don't know what the difference is worth. If he's squared up against Debo, Debo's gonna like break his collarbone and then run for a touchdown.
Yeah. So that the physicality of this Niners offense, I think, is going to be a problem. And I don't know if Purdy has the goods to like get it done for, you know, next week or in the Super Bowl. But
Super Bowl's where it's a problem, yeah.
But this week, I just think that there's enough variance to this or variability to this Niners offense where they can beat you in so many different ways where he doesn't have to be anywhere close to, you know, not like he's been Superman, but they can hide him effectively and still crush.
Also, Dan Quinn has been running a little bit different of a scheme with Dallas than he did with the Seahawks, and even the Seahawks are running a different scheme now than they did with the Legion of Boom era. But Dan Quinn is a Pete Carroll guy, and Shanahan has made that Seahawks defense really suffer a lot. So it wouldn't be terribly shocking to me if Shanahan goes into this game having identified basically a weakness in the Dallas defense that no one else has or no one else has been able to exploit. And I bet it's in the ground game. Christian McCaffrey and Debo, I think, both run for quite a bit here, and maybe even other people too. I think you almost, if you're the 49ers, you almost want to make this your Mac Jones road game or whatever, or was it? No, it was in
Buffalo, I think.
Oh, it was Buffalo. Okay, so yeah, they it's at home. There's not low temperatures or wind, but just maybe act as if there are, and the rest should work itself out.
And then of note, loyal listener Julia J. been missing from the stream the last few weeks. She's back. So, what's up?
Hey, Julia. Thanks for listening.
I even cleaned up the mustache earlier this week. So, I mean, I'm glad that it was ready for showtime as it is right now. But are you surprised at all with all this being said? Because basically the end result of you know both of our breakdowns has kind of led us to believe that the Niners win this one fairly comfortably. And yet the number is just 3.5 in favor of the Niners. And let's see here. Well, 72% of the public agrees with that sentiment, but you know, 3.5, that's where it gets tricky potentially.
Yeah. I don't mean to count Dallas out. I just think their path is a little narrower and, you know, with more conditional statements than the 49ers. I feel like the 49ers, like with the beauty of being able to run the ball really well as an offense is you don't need to make conditional statements as much. Like if you can just dictate on the ground, there's a level of certainty that you have a certain bargaining position that you always have at the outset. And it makes you more immune to the fluctuations of the game, I think. And that's something the 49ers have a decisive advantage of here. So almost on that basis alone, I would make them the favorites. But if Dallas can somehow, again, they're going to need like that big play from Hilton or maybe, I don't know, maybe Pollard is enough of a pass-catching threat demonstrated at this point that Fred Warner would concern himself with Pollard, and maybe that's how you get CeeDee Lamb set up on a post route where you get him a little bit laterally away from Ward, or better yet, against Lenoir, in between the safeties downfield. That kind of stuff could be there for Dallas, but it's like they need that big play because they can't bank on their base functions getting them anywhere. Whereas the 49ers base functions should just result in like steady gains, and they would need like anomalies to intervene against them, just as the Dallas offense at the same time needs these kind of like unlikely big plays to keep them in the conversation in the first place. So yeah, for me, it's like a 60-40 San Francisco kind of thing. The one thing that would give me pause about the cover is that if the 49ers don't make it a decisive win, if Dallas makes it a three-quarter game, then they're also pretty good at having that ending. What is it? They always lose by four. That's what Dallas does. They're really great at losing by four. They're really great at having this feeling like they're so close to making the comeback, but they never seem to make it, and they always seem to just get to like the 20-yard line of the opposing team, and it's like, you know, 4th and 11 or 4th and goal from the 14-yard line, and there's 1 second left, and they just can't seem to get that touchdown. They always get close, but they need the touchdown, so they can't get the field goal, and then they lose despite being like right at, you know, the door. So that's what I would be looking at is like San Francisco by four.
Okay, so just sneaking through, but getting there. And then Julia has interesting little topic of conversation. We can hit this quickly before we sign off. If you were to start a franchise today, Purdy, Geno, or Derek Carr?
Well, given that I'm a little skeptical of Purdy in the long term, the youth wouldn't really matter to me, but that's what he would have on Geno. So
right.
I'd go with Geno just because I think he's the best present day one and because I'm not convinced Purdy will get better. But obviously if Purdy gets better, if he's a viable starter for more than a couple years, I guess that's something you wouldn't be able to say with the two older guys.
Right. Yeah. With Purdy, you know, that in this theoretical example, you know, you're starting a franchise, like that doesn't guarantee that you have Kyle Shanahan, Debo Samuel, George Kittle, good offensive line, Christian McCaffrey. Like, I think he's done as well as you could have possibly hoped, but I don't know how much we can really take away from it or like how much he's like adding to it necessarily. He's just kind of operating how the 49ers operate.
For this question, he's either like the right answer or he's a zero. And whereas with Smith Carr, the appeal is like, well, at least you might get 2 years or something.
See, exactly. So that's kind of where I'm with it as well. And then last one, if Dallas loses this game, who is to blame for them not making the Super Bowl?
Well, I mean, it could be one of those things where, like, they did as well as they could have, and maybe there's no true blame to give out, but I think if they fell apart, it would be because their offensive line got overwhelmed while their defense was unable to stop the San Francisco ground game. So I would personally blame that on just catching the 49ers at the wrong time, but I think that's what this game will come down to.
Yeah, oddly enough, I don't really feel like there's, like, an obvious, like, this is where Jerry Jones screwed up, this is where Dak screwed up, or even Mike McCarthy.
Yeah, I mean, I will, with that said, if there is, like, a blame point, I will say it's the McCarthy hire, because I think Dallas has a lot of talent, and I don't, it's possible McCarthy's, like, staying out of the way, but that's the best he can do, and I don't know, I still believe a better coach could have done more with this team.
Yeah, no, it was strange from the start that they hired McCarthy, but here we are, and he's got them in the playoffs yet again. But that's going to do it for us here on the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast for the NFL Divisional Round. From Mario Puig, I'm John McCackney. Thanks for listening.
Try RotoWire today, free for 10 days. Get our premium tools, rankings, analysis, and breaking news alerts. No credit card required. Go to rotowire.com/try.